So take a good look at my face. You'll see my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears. The Tracks of My Tears by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest, Doug Bradley, played basketball with Smokey and the Miracles and held Dionne Warwick's hand when telling her that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. A journalist, educator, and veteran, Doug Bradley is the author of books about his Vietnam experience and co-author with Craig Werner of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War, named by Rolling Stone magazine as the best music book of 2015. Doug Bradley's most recent book is his 2025 music-based memoir, The Tracks of My Years. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Oh, Emily, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Let's start with the title of your book. I'm assuming The Tracks of My Years is a play on the Smokey Robinson title.
You're absolutely right. And it's kind of funny. When I first started writing these pieces, and I've been writing them, as you know, sometimes with the writing, you're doing it for years and years and years. That Smokey song, Smokey's essential and was really pivotal to my story, at least as a college, which I'm sure we'll get to, social chairman. In a small school in Bethany, West Virginia. But when I started to write these and I was thinking, is this ever going to be a book? The title that just presented itself was the takeoff on that and just changed tears to years. And it fits because this is what this book's about.
Well, I love the way in your book, you're writing about your own very personal experience and kind of a soundtrack to your life and songs to fit the different milestones. Certainly made me think that all of us have a soundtrack to our lives.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's part of what motivated to do this, because I had a sense that this wasn't just going to be about me. Most folks who are my demographic, you know, I'm 78. I was born in the 40s, grew up in the 50s, came aware of life and all the chaos in the 60s and on. And I think anybody from that era, I'm sure that some of the tracks might be different, but the sense, I think, of music in our lives. And, you know, the remarkable thing, Emily, now is that all the brain science that they're doing, which really is in many ways recent and just incredible, as all the science is, they're finding that music is where memory lives, that the hippocampus, sound, what you pick up, is right where your memory is. So that's why in all the work they're doing now with Alzheimer's and dementia, music is one of the through ways for people to be who they are and to remember who they are.
And, you know, I've witnessed that. My father, who's 96, plays piano at assisted living. And if he starts playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, they sing along. And it's fascinating the way music comes from some deep, different part of our memory. And, you know, that it's amazing to witness.
Well, and it harkens back to the point that you said, that there is an Emily Auerbach playlist. There's your father's playlist. There's not just 45 or 50 or 60, whatever number of songs I have in this book, but there's 600 or 6,000. But, you know, when you hear that, when you hear, like, you know, say, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
It takes you back to something.
You're right there. For me, when I hear Tracks of My Tears, I am both in that moment when I played basketball. Well, you know, back in fact, Smokey decided to sit out, so I played with the other three Miracles in a game of 2-on-2. But I'm right there. I am just back in that moment.
You decide to open your book with a kind of overture that places you with a 2-year-old daughter. And you have very conflicting feelings at that moment. And it's an interesting way to start the book, not with your own childhood, which you then get to, but this moment in your life where you're a Vietnam vet, you have a 2-year-old, and music becomes part of the story.
And a stay-at-home dad.
When
it wasn't really popular or typical. Originally, what I wanted to do was I wanted to write a story, maybe fictionalize it to an extent, you fictionalize your autobiography, about this teacher who I could never figure out in high school that stayed in my life for a while. And he was always just a question and just some way to answer some things about my life and this relationship I had with him. And, you know, I struggled and went back and forth. Meanwhile, I was constantly, because I was in a writing group and you had to produce something every week, so I was constantly bringing in these pieces because they're what presented themselves to me. You know, leaving on a jet plane, and we got to get out of this place, and all the other music's in here, Walk On By, all the songs we could go through. And then it finally struck me one time that really where all of the, a lot of this started, or this motivation for my story through the music, was this moment with my daughter Summer when she was 2 years old, and I was getting a little desperate about not working, thinking I was making my daughter a little more aggressive because she's hanging out with her father all the time, not dressing her properly, et cetera, et cetera. This was early. This is 1982 when that scene takes place. And so one of the nights I brought it into the writing group, and I started it saying I played basketball with the, you know, the Miracles, and I held Dionne Warwick's hand, and I did this and I did that. But, you know, where all this sort of resonates and starts for me is that moment with Summer when she found a song that I didn't even know that we had played and listened to that touched something deep inside me, as a parent, as a veteran, as a man, as a father, that really got this whole thing jump-started.
So instead of listening to children's songs, which were getting on your nerves, you had been playing different records, I assume they were at that time, and she had been listening, this toddler. Let's hear the You've Got Your Troubles song.
Great song.
I see that worried look upon your face. You've got your troubles, I've got mine. She's found somebody else to take your place. You've got your troubles, I've got mine.
It's a relatively obscure song. This is part of the British Invasion. The Fortunes were one of those groups. Like there were so many, yeah, not just the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, you know, the Animals, Herman's Hermits, the Fortunes. There were just a whole, Chad and Jeremy, whole wave of them. And we had a stack of 45s, as you mentioned. My wife, who's very musically inclined, has perfect pitch, you know, sings, plays piano, plays guitar. She's the artist and musician in the family. She had these old records when she was a child, like Bobo the Oboe. And, you know, I mean, and if you play enough of that, you get tired of it. And so I would sneak in these. I still had a 45 player, and I would find these old 45s that I had, and I would slide some of those in, Party Lights by Claudine Clark and, you know, On Broadway by the Drifters, just to hear something different. I Can't Help Myself by the Four Tops. And one of the songs we played that I didn't remember one day taking a break was this song. And as you know from the opening, the overture, I was having a particularly bad day, kind of feeling like I was screwing things up with my daughter. I didn't know where my life was going to go at that point, what kind of job I was going to get, not knowing I was going to have a wonderful career at the university henceforth. And, you know, I was almost near tears. I was pretty despairing. And this little cutie, you know, who I didn't realize knew, she said, play Troubles, Daddy. And I was there, okay, what are you talking about? And she walked over to this stack of records because she's got this, she's done this many times in her life, found keys and other stuff. And she picked that song out of that stack and asked me to put it on. And it just hit something in me like, wow, if I can share music with my child, if she knows how to heal me for a moment through music, and that's one of the wonderful things music does. I mean, maybe we're all right and things are going to be okay.
What about the lyrics especially spoke to you at that point?
I mean, it's just, I see that worried look upon your face. You've got your troubles. I've got mine. Yeah, the lyrics on some of these songs, it's not just because it almost has this little bouncy upbeat, da-da-da-da, as we just heard. But it's the lyrics that sort of, wow, yeah, I've got troubles. You've got troubles. Maybe we have shared troubles. We do have troubles now in the world we're living in. But maybe music is one of those ways, and that kind of connection, that kind of community you have with somebody you love, maybe it'll help you get through.
Definitely, it talks about empathy, you know, recognizing the troubles we all share. And it's amazing that she picked up on that at age two, not knowing you were a Vietnam vet with PTSD probably and all kinds of complicated other adult things, but
absolutely,
just kind of
right.
feeling that. I think sometimes being a new parent can make you think back to your own childhood, the parenting you had, for better or worse, the music you grew up, and you then go to that place in your, what you call a music-based memoir, The Tracks of My Years. Can you walk us through the childhood part of your book?
It's one of those things, and I'm sure it's folks who have always had, you know, a lot of maybe literature in their life or art. For me, it was music. It just seemed to be the thing. I really felt like my father, who, like all the dads that lived on the row houses and the inner city streets of Philadelphia I grew up on, were World War II vets. I think my dad wanted to be a singer. He had one of these crazy incidents in World War II. Prior to going into the service, he had been in a hit and run accident and had his legs broken. But he was desperate to marry my mom, so he married her on crutches. Then, of course, he gets drafted during World War II. And what do? They make him a paratrooper. First jump out of the plane, he breaks his legs again. And in fact, he ended up at Truax Field for a while. But he then would go and sing at a USO club with a band and wanted to become a singer. So his voice and his songs are in the house the whole time. Big band music, a lot of Frank Sinatra, a lot of Johnny Hartman. You know, a lot of that, the great singers of that era. My mom, the youngest of 11 in an Italian-Albanian family from South Philly, opera arias, just opera bursting when I went to her parents' house, my grandmother's house that had, you know, all the cousins and all the aunts and uncles in it. My brother was in that early wave. You know, Bandstand was there. My brother sang in a doo-wop street corner group of white guys in high school. They cut a couple records. He used to write songs. So you can just imagine what's going on for me, Emily, at this young age, taking this all in and having all this absorption of sound and then making those associations and connections. And of course, trying to have my big brother, who's 4.5 years older than me, really like having me around so I can listen to his music. It was just one of those things that was so captivating. So what I tried to do in that opening section was I couldn't ignore that. You know, I was really focusing on that high school experience, this thing with the teacher, and Vietnam, which for me were the most critical moments in my life. Just when I sort of had to get my bearings and figure out who I was and what was going to happen to me, how I was going to survive. But I couldn't ignore where that sprang. So I have this little thing, six movements in Philadelphia and six movements, because that's where the gestation period was. And it starts with one with my dad, which has a moment and then has another moment because, what fathers and discipline was like in those days. But then a few with my brother and that fight that started, that generational, disconnect, which was around music and everything else.
With your father wanting you to turn down the music or not play that
or off,
music
yes.
or whatever. It was interesting to me, too, that you, looking back, you know you were poor as a family, but it seems as if the music sort of made some riches, even if the house was leaking or something was wrong.
No, that's absolutely true. And it's that whole thing, when you are where you are, there's a bigger world out there. I thought one existed, but I wouldn't have known where Madison, Wisconsin was at the time. That's for darn sure. And it's, we had enough of each other. I never went hungry. My dad would go to work in the morning with one job and come home in the evening with another. He just was that kind of guy. I think probably had some PTSD that most of the guys in that generation never processed. We were in that cocoon of the four of us, and with my mom's extended family all around the place, around Philadelphia. But that, what music did for those moments, for that family, for our being together, even when there were the disconnects with my brother and my father fighting over something, it was a sonorous way to grow up.
It's hard to know, since you've got, I think, 50 or 60 songs on the playlist that goes along with this book, which one to look at. But I wonder if you could sort of set up the one, 16 Candles, and talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it was this amazing, it was a great song by a group called The Cress, which back in the day, and a lot of people, I don't think, remember this about the early days of rock and roll, so because the song came out in 58, 59. This was an integrated group. Johnny Maestro, who was the lead singer of The Cress, was white. One of the other guys in the group was white, and the other two singers were black. So, you know, here we are, music finding a way for us to integrate when the country couldn't. And that was a wonderful thing. You'll find a lot of that with some of the groups of that era, that they had mixed races in the groups. So, and they just hit it with the song because it starts off, you know, happy birthday, baby. Ooh, I love you so. you know, what's better for a 16-year-old to be dancing close with the boy or girl that they got a crush on? And the amazing thing about that was that my brother happened to be going to the most popular dance that night in Philadelphia on his 16th birthday. So here it is, 1959, January, Ron Bradley turned 16, and his girlfriend at the time found a way to get to the DJ. They had DJs, they had bands. I think Danny and the Juniors, the At the Hop guys, were playing that night, or they were going to be there. This is even pre-Dick Clark. Dick Clark's just starting to emerge with American Bandstand. And she convinces this guy to make this a special lady's choice for her to go over to my brother, get him on the dance floor, and dance the 16 candles. Well, I mean, you'd have thought you died and going to heaven. Just what an experience for a kid in, you know, in America at that time. Well, you know, he did stay out too late. And he, you know, he might have had a beer or two. I don't know. But I'm up in bed, in a bedroom he and I shared. And when he comes in, you know, I hear this ruckus because my parents stayed up because he's late. And so he can't get in. My father's got to let him in. The door's locked. And they have this encounter, a rough one, in just in terms of language, about Ron being uplifted. You know, he's everything my father isn't right now. He's cool. He's young. He looks great. He's happy. My dad is, you know, starting to gain weight and, you know, worried about money and jobs and all the things that, you know, dads in that generation. And so, and my brother's got the record. You know, Peggy, his girlfriend, handed him the record. So it was just interesting to watch my mom trying to get either out of the way or in the way because, you know, she doesn't want something to escalate because, unfortunately, at times it did with dads of those that generation. And it was all sort of reverberating about this music, and it made me think, and I've got another story in there prior to that about a song called Over the Mountain Across the Sea, that we were finding ways to distance ourselves or become different than our parents. I mean, I know that always happens, but I'm, you know, 4.5, 5 years younger, and I'm just trying to observe and figure it out. Ron is already in that, and music became that pivot point that, you know, my parents could even maybe tolerate Elvis. You know, Pat Boone was, you know, doing cover stuff of black music. But Little Richard and Chuck Berry, I mean, you're going way too far. So it was just interesting to see that dynamic physically played out between my brother and my father with 16 candles.
We'll listen to that and then come back on University of the Air and talk more about Doug Bradley's book, The Tracks of My Years. I'm Emily Auerbach with Doug Bradley, and we are talking about music and memoir. Music as a way to look back at your life, the milestones of it, the memories. You were talking about witnessing as a, I suppose, maybe 12-year-old, 11, 12-year-old, your brother at 16, sort of claiming his own generation, his own identity through musical difference with your father. When you kind of hit that point yourself, when you became a high school student and DJ and, yes, you know, all that, how did music then start playing a big role in your life?
Well, it absolutely did. Thanks to my brother and his interests, we developed a fantastic record collection. You know, some of your listeners who are of our demographic can remember those days when albums were expensive. They were big. You know, you had to have a 33 and a third record player, you know, and sometimes that was what your parents played their music on, like they did at my house. But those little 45 things that RCA and others made that with just a spindle already in it, and you just pop a stack of records on there. So that's what we did. And we amassed an incredible record collection. My brother had good taste and, you know, found ways to, you know, buy songs. He used all his allowance, you know, when he had a job, or, you know, trade for songs. So we had this great record collection. So I inherited that. He's off at college. It's a small California State University, which is in California, PA, not in California. And I'm home, and I've got this abundance of music. So I started to be the guy that would get invited to play at sock hops and
be the DJ.
Dances. I was a DJ. And so music was very essential then and there. And then there came a moment in my life, and I still can't remember exactly what it is that went south. Maybe I was just too big for my britches. I just moved into this school district. We had moved from Philadelphia to Ohio, and then 2 years in Ohio, and then the Pittsburgh suburbs. So I'd started at the school and maybe got a little ahead of myself, thought I was, you know, a little too cool or whatever. And I got blackballed by all the guys in my group, which at that point, when, you know, you're that age and your friends are everything, your peer group and acceptance, I was devastated. And music was a place that gave me comfort. Unfortunately, some of that was really sad, you know, doo-wop songs, you know, about, you know, girlfriends breaking up with you or cheating on you, or you're having your heart broken, or you're just pining away for somebody. And I took a little too much comfort and solace.
Kind of wallowing.
I hate to say it, but I was feeling sorry for myself. The best thing that came out of that, frankly, out of that whole thing, was not just developing this relationship with this teacher and what I was and trying to navigate and figure that out, which became a whole different roller coaster, but writing about it. I always liked to write. I was interested in it. I had won a couple contests in parochial school and, you know, seventh and eighth grade. So I knew I could do this, but I never saw it as a way for therapy, for healing, for me. And that's what I found when I was on the outs. And you know what it's like if you're in cliquey circles, and hopefully high school's better than that nowadays.
Oh, no, it's not.
Probably not. Yeah, probably
not from what I hear.
What my kids went through. That, you know, other people didn't want to befriend me either because they want to be on outs with the folks that were the movers and shakers. And so, you know, there I was, kind of friendless, kind of lonesome, kind of desperate. And I started to write. Saved me.
And what did you find was the relationship between the writing and the music? Like, did sometimes a song trigger something you wrote, or you'd be writing and it would remind you of a song?
That's well put. Both and. I mean, and that's sort of what happened. I even wrote some really bad lyrics and some really bad poetry for some really some really insipid ballads. But yeah, it would come and go. And, you know, I started to keep a journal, and I still do. Here I am, 78 years old, and just the night before last, there I am sitting writing something down about a thought I had that day or a memory or, an aspiration. That's really where it worked for me. And luckily, we had I had this great teacher who not only taught 11th grade English. I was at AP English in 10th grade, but then dropped out of that because I wanted to be where the fun was. And this guy was supposedly the most fun teacher in the high school. And then he started on his own, made a creative writing class in 12th grade. So my junior and senior years in high school were just filled with writing assignments. I was still playing a little music. You know, I mean, they didn't have a substitute DJ, but I wasn't dancing at the dances, and I was going home alone often. But again, that symbiotic relationship between words and pain and writing and awareness and music was, that was all of it.
One of the songs you talk about in that section of the book is Be Fair. Can you talk about that song?
Well,
how does it
said,
fit in?
It is one of these, I don't know why it hit in this Doug Bradley sweet spot. We had, you know, I mean, as you know, we all had the shared, the same soundtrack in those days, whether you lived in Poughkeepsie or Pittsburgh or Seattle or Saginaw. We listened to the same pretty much top 20, top 40 list. I think Clyde Coffey was the guy my wife used to talk about that she listened to here in Madison, radio DJ, and they all had the same shtick. But also in Pittsburgh, we had this guy who was one of a kind. His name was Porky Chedwick, and he used to call himself the daddy-o of the radio. And Porky played really authentic R&B, what they called then race music. He would pretty much feature black artists and doo-wop on his show. He wouldn't play Elvis Presley because he thought he was too country. He played Big Mama Thornton's version of Hound Dog, which Elvis stole and covered. So, and Porky just became a place to go. I didn't want to listen to the popular tunes. They reminded me too much maybe of what wasn't going right. So I'd listened a lot to his show on WAMO, WAMO. And here's this song by the Galaheads. I'm sure they were a one-hit wonder. I don't know if anybody's ever heard this song by the Galaheads, but it's about a, it, you know, and it's a bad setup. It's a blind boy and his girlfriend, and you know they're together, and he thinks she's in love with him, and he, of course, he's in love with her, and then he realizes that she's cheating on him. He can't see it, but he senses it, he hears it, he feels it, and so he's basically talking to her through the narrative of the song. You know, be fair. You know, please be fair to me. I can't see. I love you with all my heart. Don't do this to me. And that sort of became, you know, me sort of saying to this you know, group that had sort of put me, had ostracized me. It's like, come on, be fair. I mean, you know, I made a mistake, you know, or I did something wrong. I mean, if I hurt somebody's, but I mean, do I need to go through all this, you know, my junior and senior years of high school? So used a great word before, wallowed. That's a good one for Doug Bradley at this point in his life. A little too much wallowing.
Okay, let's hear Be Fair.
A blind boy and his girl were crossing the street one day, and I shuddered as I passed them when I heard him say,
Be fair, darling.
So that's Be Fair by Charles Wright and the Galaheads, and you could wallow with that. You also talk about the growing sense in the country that a lot is happening, you know, with the kind of growing awareness of Vietnam, with rioting, with all kinds of protests and conflicts. Can you talk about the historical context? Because we've mostly talked about, you know, sort of your childhood, high schools, and the music. But outside of that is this world that's a turbulent state.
Was it ever? And I have to admit that I was in a bit of a bubble. I went to a very small school in West Virginia called Bethany College, Northern Panhandle, sort of between Wheeling and Pittsburgh. Just got lucky. I'm first generation. We don't have any money. You know, neither of my parents went to college. So they gave me a scholarship, a loan, and work study. So, hey, somebody cares enough about me to throw some money. You know, I raised a good Catholic boy. I had got accepted at Notre Dame, but couldn't afford to go to Notre Dame. I go to Bethany. And it wasn't where all this turmoil, but it eventually got there. I mean, because let's face it, in that era, where, you know, Gulf of Tonkin was August of 64. So I'm starting school in, you know, September of 65. You know, the Marines had, you know, landed that previous March. So things are starting to hit. We're starting to know more about, and we all registered for Selective Service. We were 18. We're all potentially 1A. I mean, we are going to fight this war. And even though you had the student deferment, this is before the lottery, this is the way the draft selective service classification went, you had to make a decision every day about Vietnam. I mean, it was right there. And the closer you got to getting out of school, the older you got, the more that was going on, the more that came into your life. And the other incredible thing is, Emily, and I think you alluded to this, is that music in some ways was counterpointing that, anticipating that, being prescient about that, reflecting that. You know, the Beach Boys go from fun, fun, fun to Good Vibrations. You know, James Brown is, you know, I feel good to say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. I mean, you know, all the music, whether it was protest or whether it was just pop, but it was roiling too. And it was just this time where it seemed like everything was up for grabs and everything was changing and we were just holding on. So even at Little Bethany, where I said none of this was happening, when I had the association there, who are Along Comes Mary and Cherish and all that, you know, sort of, you know, lovely pop stuff, the song they opened with the night they were there was Requiem, which is about Vietnam. You know, it's almost like mass and it's about Vietnam. It's like, how did that happen?
And you're arranging for many different groups to come and perform. And you write about being the one who told Dionne Warwick about Martin Luther King. I mean, what an astonishing moment that must have been.
It was one of those moments that I still get sort of goosebumps and just, you know, pain. I feel some pain again because she was absolutely huge at the time, you know, hit after hit after hit, Hal David and Burt Bacharach. And her, I mean, just that symbiosis. But she had a very feisty agent. See, the great thing is that we got to work directly with agents in New York and L.A. I don't know how the guy that I was co-chairman with, and then he had to go into reserves, got out of school early, and I was doing this pretty much on my own, how we made these connections. Once you do, and you know, it's like anything, the relationships that you build. Look what you've done with all your work and Odyssey. So we had these relationships. So we had direct access to the acts. We didn't have to go through somebody in Pittsburgh or Cleveland. We're in New York and L.A. Well, Dionne, I think her agent at some point, it looked at the map. Contract had been signed. So first she was supposed to be there in November of 67. Then she was supposed to be there in January of 68. They canceled twice. Couldn't cancel three times. So they pick April 4th, 1968. Who knew that that was going to become the day that it did? And it was just one of those moments when, you know, you thought the world was going to end.
And she had started the concert. What kinds of songs had she already sung by that point?
She had done her whole set. We were going to do a lot of the contracts then were 2 45-minute acts, yeah, with a break, and then maybe an encore or two. She, because she had flown in on private planes out of the Virginia, D.C. area, wanted to fly back, had something else to do. Her band came separately, different, you know. And so, and it was just a little combo, but they were great, and they were in sync, in harmony. So she wanted to get out a little early, and we said, no problem. You do a straight 90-minute set, all the hits, you know, Anyone Who Had a Heart, Walk On By. She premiered that night, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? You know, I Say a Little Prayer, everything. Gets off the stage. The dean is there, and I can tell something's going on. You know, people backstage, and I said, "What?" And he tells me, and I turn, and she's looking at me, like, "What's wrong?" Because you know, I'll go back, I'll do one more song. They're clapping, and I said, I just blurted it out because I was like stunned, and she just sank. And then, being the person and artist she is, she said, "I want to go out and sing a trip. All I can do now is I want to sing. I want to sing my heart out for Martin." And we had this dumb little sheriff there. And, you know, this is a liberal arts, pretty white school. And just because Dionne had brought in, you know, a few more people of color and, you know, folks from outside of the campus, you know, he thought there was going to be turmoil. So he flips up the lights and clears the auditorium. So that wonderful tribute concert, that might have been absolutely spellbinding, never happened. And then the real, really ugly codicil to that is when we get back to the airport and we're walking back and everybody, it's silence. One of the pilots or, you know, co-pilot is there. They've stayed at the airport and then they didn't have TB's at this little airport in Wheeling, West Virginia. He says, it looks like you guys have been at a funeral rather than, you know, a concert. And I said something to him, and he said, it's about time somebody shot that black SOB. So
that's a night you'll never forget.
I will never forget. And I don't know how she could ever get back on the plane with that guy. And I'm surprised that guy, that the band members, one of them was trying to wring his neck. But there's America for you on a night like that in this small place in West Virginia.
One of the songs you talk about, Abraham, Martin, and John, kind of speaks to some of that. Can you set that song up?
Well, and I think you set it up perfectly because there's Martin right in the middle of that. So now it's senior year. And what people, I think, don't remember about the previous spring when Johnson said he wasn't going to run for reelection was that same speech that night, he canceled all graduate school deferments. In those days, you could keep your student deferment into grad school. He canceled them that night except for doctors and dentists. So I'm going to law school thinking I'm going to keep my – I wanted to be a lawyer, but I'm also thinking I'm keeping my 2S deferment while I go to law school. Uh-uh. So now I know it's up for grabs. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to make the decision in my life. But everybody, you know, let's party like it's 1999 or something. Enjoy this while you got it. You know, it's 1969. You're getting a college degree, you've got maybe a great future ahead of you, but the specter of Vietnam. So everybody's listening to Hey Jude, you know, which was huge then, popular, and, you know, music was still doing a lot for us. I'm listening to Abraham, Martin, and John because, you know, I grew up knowing Dion and Dion and the Belmonts and some of their hits, both as a group and then when Dion split off. This is a totally different guy now. I mean, this is almost like a folk song, and it's this tribute to, you know, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy. And then at the end, you know, he says, I think I see Bobby up over the hill walking with Abraham, Martin, and John because RFK had just been killed. I mean, again, this whole thing. I mean, Martin Luther King's a set, Bobby Kennedy's a set, and, you know, John F. Kennedy. Are we all going to die? I mean, this was just, it felt like you were on some kind of death trip. And then you got Vietnam. So, yeah, I burrowed into that song. And I felt some comfort from that, of just the way Dion sang that, you know, there were people like this in the world. Maybe there'll be more. Maybe they'll stay alive. Maybe I'll be okay. But, wow, it was so tumultuous.
Anybody here seen my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just look round and he's gone. Didn't they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? Then we'll be free someday. Soon is gonna be one day.
That's Abraham, Martin, and John. We are going to follow Doug Bradley to Vietnam and back home from Vietnam when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Doug Bradley, and we are talking about his music-based memoir, The Tracks of My Years. Doug, I know a big part of your life is having been a veteran, having served in Vietnam, and you wrote in the book that you co-authored with Craig Werner, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, about all the soldiers, how much what the radio would play meant to them, how they would bet on what song was going to come up next, and just how music would sometimes pull veterans together, soldiers at the time and then veterans later. Can you talk a little bit about what music has meant to you as a Vietnam veteran?
Boy, I mean, everything, Emily. And I think that was really, I sort of felt that sense that was my experience, and realize I'm in the rear in Vietnam, so that's different than being in the field. but that was more common than uncommon. Of about the nearly 3 million people who served in the Pacific Theater, in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, only about 500,000 were combat. That doesn't, you know, I'm not in any way taking away from that heroism, that courage, that job. But the rest of us are supporting them. I'm writing stories. Somebody else is making their meals. Somebody else is driving the trucks.
Yeah, so, my husband was cracking codes.
Yeah, yes. And so, and they knew, the military knew at the time, and I'll say one thing they got right was that we were the rock and roll generation, that, you know, music was in our DNA. And even if you're out in the field where there's silence, I mean, you're not there all the time. You're having music. You know, Armed Forces Vietnam Network had transmitters from the DMZ to the Delta and was 24/7. You know, you'll still have people having arguments like we did in the excerpt that you mentioned in the book about, you know, what DJs were better if they played good songs. But they did their best. But somebody in the Hooch would have a guitar. We had not just radios, but reel-to-reel and cassette decks. So we had music. We had bands, cover bands, Filipino, Korean, Vietnamese, couldn't speak a word of English, but they could nail a playlist. You know, we had groups come. Johnny Cash went to Vietnam. Nancy Sinatra went to Vietnam. James Brown went to Vietnam. Bob Hope always brought somebody with him, music. So my point is that they knew that that was important and they gave it to us. So that was elemental and essential for me to sort of keep alive. And again, all the great music that's coming out at that time, and the music was just so good. The best of Motown, the best of country, the best of the British invasion. And it just stayed there. And, you know, it was a way for us not only to connect with one another, we soldiers at the time, but also with the people back home. They're listening to the same songs. Purple Haze might mean something a little different to us because we see purple smoke grenades at landing zones. But, you know, they're listening to it. We're listening to it. And so that sense of community, both the bond that we had as soldiers, then veterans, and then also with the people back home, music was what did that. That was the glue or the cement.
And it's interesting how the lyrics take on such different meanings. Even the song that was the title of your other book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, in terms of getting out of Vietnam, or something that might have been written about a love relationship or something, can take on different meanings. Chain of Fools, about the military, Chain of Command, or taking lyrics that other people listen to in a completely different way and having it mean something. You write about the song Fire and Rain, the James Taylor song, as having special meaning. How so?
It was basic training. And so here you are, and you're thrown into this mishmash of 50 other people, 49, you know, a platoon, with drill sergeant. I mean, it's in some ways like the movies, you know. I mean, they control your life.
They're barking orders.
Oh, boy. They browbeat you, especially when they found out there were two college graduates in my platoon. So go figure. So we were getting they were on, you know, college boy, you know, you think you're smarter. You think you're, and also to go to OCS, Officers Candidate School. We need more officers. What are you doing in here with these lowlifes? You know, I mean, just constant. It's just the way that functions. That's just the ethos. And so we had this guy that what you would do sometimes is, and it would rotate among the 50 guys, is somebody always had to stay up. Yeah. So, you know, if you were up for 3 or 4 hours and, you know, it went through the alphabet, the next guy up was like getting KP too, would be up for 4 hours. And we had one guy who always wanted to be the guy that got everybody up at 4 or 5 o'clock, when whatever the detail was for that day. And I don't, you know, we called him Baby Fat Bob. I don't know even if his name was Bob, but that's what we could probably was. And that's what we caught him, because he still had a little bit of baby fat. He was getting trimmed up in basic training, as all of us were. And he would sing Fire and Rain in the morning. And he really had a nice voice. And, you know, to wake up without somebody barking right away. I mean, we'd get that, too. But to hear this sweet voice of this guy who sometimes would even change the James Taylor lyrics to apply to our situation was kind of, I don't know, healing or helpful or just a better way to start the day. And so that was, and all those questions that arise. I mean, it's like you still don't know. I mean, you're there, and you're getting browbeaten, you're getting pushed down to build you back up as a unit, and take away your individuality. And it's probably the hardest 8 weeks of your life. And and you have no idea what's coming next. You don't know where you're going to go next. You know, I got lucky. Most of the guys in the other 49 weren't so lucky.
Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way. Whoa, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Seen sunny days that I thought would never
I think the song end. Also brings up the idea of loss. You know, I always thought that I'd see you again, and you do write in your book about loss, losing fellow soldiers, kind of losing touch with this teacher that meant a lot in terms of encouraging your love of literature, losing touch with different people along the way. When you came back from Vietnam, how were you sort of permanently altered? And how did sort of music help you with that? You know, it was a hard war for people to return from because it was such a contested war. You yourself were sort of against the war while serving in it.
Correct.
So,
well, and people, that's another thing people don't realize is about a third of the military and the service members at the time. Well, a couple things. There were 27 million of us baby boomers that were eligible for the draft during that era. 10 million served. So a lot of people think nobody served or everybody went and hid it on college campus. That's better than a third of the population. Now, only about close to 3 million are in Vietnam, but still, people stood up and served. But because you had the specter of Vietnam, about a third of the Army was guys who wanted to do this. You know, this was, you know, World War II dads, you know, stop fascism, we got to stop communism. They believed in the cause of the mission. Another third enlisted because they didn't want to get drafted and maybe get a bad job, yet become an infantryman. And so they signed up for a job, which, of course, might end up getting them in Vietnam anyway. The military controls you. And the other third were draftees like me. And by 69, 70, when I'm getting drafted and going through all this, you know, we're leaving. We announced that we're leaving. You know, we're going to get out of here, out of this place, turn the ground war over to the South Vietnamese, escalate the air war, get the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to the negotiating table. So why be the last GI killed in Vietnam? So... yeah, that was the tenor of the time. And music was central to that. Now, realize, again, we didn't go over as units. We didn't come home as units. I flew over to Vietnam with 175 strangers. I flew home with 175 strangers. I get dropped into my little community outside of Philadelphia where my parents are living at the time. I don't know if there's a Vietnam vet 5 minutes or 500 miles from me. And you need that kind. I mean, and you're in the jungle one day. You're in the replacement battalion the next. You're in the Freedom Bird the next. You're in processing out in either Fort Lewis or Travis. And then you're home. That is no decompression from that war. And then the country's roiling, thinking maybe a guy in uniform likes this. Maybe, you know, I mean, it was, I think, the worst time, and it's not having a pity party, but to be a veteran in this country. And so, man, what was there to hold on to? Music.
And you write, I have to say, in a very raw, vulnerable, and honest way about depression, about almost wanting to end it. And we know the statistics on veterans and suicide. We know about PTSD, and it wasn't so widely talked about then. But you write about, you know, moments of real despair and darkness and sort of having music, other people help pull you back from literally a cliff.
Absolutely. And relationships. I don't want to belie that. I mean, I think if you talk to a lot of Vietnam vets who've made it, they'll say it was the love of a woman because it's, you know, I mean, there were women in Vietnam, but not that many in total numbers. And yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, like I said, you had no time to process this. You had no parade. You had no welcoming. You had no reconciliation. The country maybe some people think you're a baby killer. Some people think you're a patriot. Some people don't know. They're glad it wasn't them. So, yeah, it was. And again, I'm not trying to say, you know, a lot of us didn't make it back unscathed, and we did, but there was always this other part. And for me, thinking going back to a campus, forget law school, I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to get an advanced degree in English. I'm going to read and write and think and maybe have fun with other people of the same. No, there weren't any Vietnam vets there, you know, and I'm, you know, now I'm 3,000 miles from home. I'm in Pullman, Washington. And yeah, I was struggling. And again, it was music and a professor and literature, I think, that helped get me out.
Let's end in terms of the last song we'll hear with Ripple. Set that up for us.
I fell in love. I got lucky. I met a woman from Madison, Wisconsin, who had been here during the tumultuous time. She went here. Pam went as an undergrad from 68 to 72 and then joined the Domestic Peace Corps, VISTA. She was a VISTA volunteer, worked with the tribes in northern Wisconsin, and then was either, when I met her, she was either going to go join the Peace Corps proper, go to law school, or go travel again. She had grown up overseas part of her life. Her dad was with the Foreign Foundation, great university professor, by the way, Ted Shannon, in extension, no less. And so I met her at this time where this was what she was making her decisions. And, you know, it was just, you know, when somebody says, would you do it all over again if you knew what it was? And I said, yeah, because how else would I have met Pam? How else would I have the kids and grandkids that I have? And so Pam came into my life, and she was a Deadhead. Yeah, she had been to a lot of Grateful Dead concerts, knew their music inside and out, and knew, I think, what people don't realize is sometimes the artistry and the complexity of the stories that Robert Hunter would write for Jerry Garcia and the Dead. And Ripple was just one of those songs. If you know, it's a beautiful song about Ripple on Still Waters, and it's about the narrator becoming the story, becoming the song, about teaching the song, then back to the narrator. It's really interesting and intricate. And just having Pam in my life, bringing me to Madison, which, you know, who would ever thought in my life, that wasn't on my radar to go from, you know, maybe staying out east in Philadelphia or somewhere out east, and then I'm in, you know, Western Washington, Eastern Washington State, and then I end up in Madison, Wisconsin. But she saved my life, and Madison saved my life, because no sooner do I get here, and I stumble in this place called Vets House. And we were, other vets, we were doing the work that needed to be done that other people weren't doing for us.
We'll go out on Ripple, and before we do that, I want to thank my guest, Doug Bradley, author of The Tracks of My Years, a music-based memoir. Doug, thank you for your service, thank you for your love of music, and thank you for your writing.
No, Emily, thank you. It's nice always to be with you.
I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Ripple in still water, when there is no pebble tossed, no wind to blow, reach out your hand. If your cup be empty, if your cup is full, may it be.